When the universe was weighed under a layer of such darkness that even shadows didn't stir, Grandmother Spider began to weave her great web, spinning the world into existence. She cast the dew that clung to the silvery threads into the wide open space, transforming them into countless shimmering stars. Channeled through this divine feminine power, the universe awakened.
From her web, Grandmother Spider observed the first thoughts as the universal mind awakened from the dream. Grandmother Spider took a very deep breath and softly began to sing her weaving song while she danced across the sky. The sky world filled with light and life as her creative process unfolded.
The Native American story of Grandmother Spider speaks to my very soul. Her vision, energy, and mystery breathe the essence of the divine feminine. It's an essence I perceive more deeply every day in my own Muslim faith and see reflected in a spectrum of traditions, cultures, and stories. It is both nostalgia and new discovery, familiar and strange, mystical and human. I'm fascinated, awed, and challenged by its varied manifestations. For the divine feminine is many things. It is wisdom, maternal love, spiritual liberation, but it is also sexual power, threat, and retribution. The 12th century Benedictine abbess, Hildegard of Bingen, said of the divine feminine,
"She is so bright and glorious that you cannot look at her face or her garments for the splendor with which she shines. For she is terrible with the terror of the avenging lightning, and gentle with the goodness of the bright sun. But she is with everyone and in everyone. And so beautiful is her secret that no person can know the sweetness with which she sustains people and spares them in inscrutable mercy."
But the legacy of the divine feminine is in danger, overshadowed by aggressive patriarchy that has tipped the scales, leaning the world towards confusion, social injustice, and fractured belief. For me, a return to the divine feminine is a return to consciousness. It awakens ancient imagination and offers equilibrium. But only if we, women and men, trace the divine feminine within us and hear it resounding in the world around. I recently went on a journey, a pilgrimage of sorts that took me to England's Nazareth. Thousands of pilgrims flock every year to Norfolk, where in the 11th century, a noblewoman saw a vision of the Blessed Virgin Mary. The shrine of Our Lady of Walsingham is a peaceful and deeply powerful place.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem.
I felt the legacy of two great faith traditions come together as I performed the midday Muslim prayer in the courtyard outside the Christian shrine. In the Quran, Mary is told to prostrate and bow down with those who worship. I felt the veils of 2,000 years fall away as I repeated the prayer movements that my heroine, the Virgin Mary, performed. Mary, or Maryam in Arabic, is the only woman named in the Quran. The sacred verse that declares, "God has chosen you over the women of all the worlds," fills me with an awe that is only an atom's worth of what Mary must have experienced. I knew how important she is to Muslims throughout my childhood, but it was only as an adult that I discovered some scholars consider her a female prophet. This was a pivotal moment. I saw the Quran in a new light. That the angel of revelation spoke to her, that she is included in the Quranic chapter entitled The Prophets, that her profound bond with the divine was mentioned over and over, means for me she embodies the virtues of prophethood. Mary was constantly surrounded and sustained by divine presence. And it's the divine dwelling presence, Shekhinah in Hebrew, that a female rabbi tells me she sings of to her children at night.
May our right hand bring us closer to our godliness. May our left hand give us strength to face each day. And before us may our vision
Shekhinah is the feminine aspect of God. Medieval Kabbalists often portrayed the feminine Shekhinah as a loving mother who suffers alongside her children in exile in the desert wilderness. In the book of Exodus, Shekhinah manifests in the water of the Red Sea, in the rolling clouds above, in the air that moves around them. Rabbi Leah Novick, in her book On the Wings of Shekhinah, observes that this divine presence can bring a vital balance to the world.
Finally, the role of women in creating and expressing their Shekhinah awareness in their own words makes it possible for women to project their visions and experiences of Shekhinah to a world desperate for rebalancing. I feel Shekhinah's presence. In the growing concern for the environment, in the connectedness that technology has given us, I believe that divine energy is inherent in the instant contact we have around the world and can lead us to become a global community.
Rabbi Novick emphasizes the unifying essence of Shekhinah, but Shekhinah can also be vengeful, a fierce punisher of the wicked. It's a captivating contradiction that I recognize more sharply in the ancient Sumerian religion, where the goddess Inanna presents a radically unnurturing vision of the feminine. She is the fierce destroyer as goddess of war, combat, and political power. But she is also venerated as the goddess of sexual love and fertility. A clay tablet dated 2300 BCE depicts Inanna towering over male captives that she presents to a king. Her foot presses upon the neck of one prisoner. Her hand pulls another chained through the nose. Inanna cuts a fearful yet mesmerizing figure. It's no wonder she was among the most revered deities in ancient Mesopotamia. Rosemary Ruther, in her book Goddesses and the Divine Feminine, observes,
Inanna does not patronize motherhood, childcare, or weaving. She establishes kings on their thrones, but she does so as a nubile bride who never becomes a submissive wife. We should see Inanna's sexuality as expressing the power through which the divine, as female, touched the highest ranks of the male human world.
As goddess of war, Inanna is depicted carrying weapons in a flounced robe. But as goddess of sexual love, she is often depicted nude. Nudity is an uncomfortable concept in Abrahamic faiths, which includes my own. But discovering the symbolism of the female body in other cultures widens my perception of the divine feminine, which itself moves like water, fluid, versatile, and dynamic. For the African sacred feminine, the female form was a manifestation of female energy. As seen in many images from Neolithic times, dynastic Egypt, and pre-colonial West Africa. The African-American singer Beyoncé channeled the power of Oshun, the Nigerian Yoruba deity of water, sexuality, and fertility, for her album Lemonade.
I tried to change. Closed my mouth more. Tried to be softer, prettier, less awake.
Hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up, they don't love you like I love you. Step down, they don't love you like I love you.
Beyoncé's own history with body image has been controversial, but through Oshun, I can see how Beyoncé's tribute signals a rebirth of an ancient celebration of sacred sexuality before colonial rule sought to crush the African feminine divine. Professor Arisika Razak, in her essay on sacred women of Africa and the African diaspora, writes,
"The art presents images of Black women's bodies at a time when blackness was not perceived as a negative quality, but was an affirmation of inherent beauty, sacredness, and power. I see these diverse images of sacred women, elemental female powers, deified ancestors or black goddesses, as collective manifestations of the African sacred feminine, which offer a healing template to the wounds of racial misogyny that African-American women still experience in regard to their bodies, their sexualities, and their social and spiritual roles."
The wounds of misogyny that Professor Razak speaks of are painfully familiar. Women in countless cultures and times have suffered from its infliction, yet many also reclaim their agency through a divine mandate. I recognise the struggle for agency in the 19th century women's rights movement. Ever since I've been able, I've exercised my right to vote. As a woman, I am conscious that each vote I cast is a tribute to the suffrage movement and to my own autonomy. But deeper than this is my knowledge that the movement was buttressed by activists like Charlotte Despard, Ava Gore Booth, and Frances Swinney, whose Christian faith spurred their struggle for political rights. For them, the suffrage movement was a spiritual movement. A vociferous Frances Swinney, in her book The Awakening of Women, writes,
"Men's contempt and misuse of womanhood has been the chief hindrance to the moral evolution of the race. I would earnestly urge upon my fellow sisters the solemn and supreme obligations of action. Above all things, never to drift. Never to be content with a program of negatives. It is not, I am not as other women are, that will better the life or lighten the way for those others. It is the ready response to the divine call that comes once to each of us. Here am I, send me. That is the keynote of progress."
Swinney didn't merely call for the equality of women, but asserted their moral, intellectual, and spiritual superiority. She claimed there was only one sex, the feminine, and that men were simply imperfect women. I would have loved to see her battle it out with Aristotle, the ancient Greek philosopher who believed that it was women who were incomplete men. His notion sat in sharp contrast to the original Wonder Woman, the Amazonian warrior. Amazons were a mythological tribe of women that epitomized threat to the male social order of the ancient Greeks. The Amazons fought wars, trained daughters, killed sons. The idea of a female-powered tribe has always intrigued me. Perhaps it's why I've been so drawn towards the priestesses enshrined in Arthurian legend, figures who've enchanted me since I was a young girl. In The Mists of Avalon, a novel by Marion Zimmer Bradley, the author reimagines the masculine tale through a feminist lens and revitalizes ancient Celtic belief in the great mother goddess and her female priestesses. Bradley's novel poignantly unravels their fate as the divine feminine is replaced with the male god of Christianity. Yet there is also a hint of reconciliation expressed by Morgaine.
The strife is over. I could greet Arthur at last when he lay dying, not as my enemy and the enemy of my goddess, but only as my brother, as a dying man in need of the mother's aid, where all men come at last. Even the priests know this, with their ever-Virgin Mary in her blue robe, for she too becomes the world mother in the hour of death. I have called on the goddess and found her within myself.
While the ancient Celtic belief of the mother goddess seems radically at odds with my Islamic faith, what strikes me here are the echoes of Allah's feminine attributes. In Islam, God is neither male nor female, yet the creator is likened, if not intrinsically linked, to a mother figure. One of Allah's names, which I repeat every day, Ar-Rahman, means invariably the most merciful, the most loving, the most compassionate. The word derives from the same root meaning for womb, rahim. God's love is like a mother's love for its baby as she sustains it in her womb. I feel the divine rhythm with every beat of my heart as both God's love and my mother's love pumps through my veins. The love is unconditional. Unconditional love is the stuff of song, poetry, and the human experience. The song Layla by Eric Clapton was inspired by the story of Layla and Majnun that he read in a 12th century Persian poem. Clapton saw himself in Majnun as he was also madly in love with a woman he could not be with.
What do you do when you get lonely? No one waiting by your side. You've been running, hiding much too long. It's just your foolish pride. Layla, got me on my knees.
Layla and Majnun's story holds even deeper meaning. Layla herself represents the divine beloved, and Majnun symbolizes the Sufi consumed in yearning to reach her sacred essence. In one version of the tale, Majnun, while on pilgrimage, stands in front of the Kaaba, the first house of worship in Islam, and wonders if the draped monument he sees before him is Layla as a veiled bride. In a love letter to the object of his devotion, Majnun writes,
"Oh, my beloved, had I not given my soul to you, trembling with desire like the wind, it would have been better to lose it. I would not be worth the dust in which I am lying. Look, I am being consumed by the fire of my love, drowned in the tears of my unhappiness. Even the sun, which illumines the world, is singed by the heat of my sighs. Invisible candle of my soul, do not torture the night moth fluttering around you. My longing for you is the consolation of my heart, its wound and its healing salve.
While Majnun gives us the archetype of male yearning for the eternal divine, Mirabai, the 16th century Hindu saint poetess, is a luminous example of female devotion. Mirabai was of royal blood, but persecuted by her own in-laws and even threatened with death. Yet she was determined to reach God, whatever the obstacles. She was once refused entry to a large temple by a renowned master on grounds that only men could worship within it. She asked, "Isn't God the only male? Is not the rest of his creation female?" She was promptly given admittance. For in Hinduism, the only male, Purusha, is God, while the creative energy, Prakriti, which comprises everything else in creation, is female. Mirabai composed countless poems and sang the words of love, joy, and devotion to Krishna with such enduring beauty that her poems are chanted to this day. Ranjana Ghatak sings a poem by Mirabai.
Toma mora ho.
Centuries before Mirabai lived her predecessor of a different faith. This woman's piety was rich as she was poor, for on the night she was born, there was no cloth to wrap her in, nor oil to light the lamp. The child was Rabia al-Adawiya, the first female Sufi saint, who, despite entering the world in darkness, left a truly illuminating legacy. Rabia was arguably the most influential Sufi woman in history, affecting centuries of Islamic philosophy and mystic thinking. She forged a path towards divine love that went beyond religion as duty and law. Rabia al-Adawiya inspires my love for the divine in ways that I'd never previously imagined. 1300 years after she worshipped, Rabia lets me taste the sweetness of faith with words that capture her yearning for God.
My love, my joy, my hunger, my shelter, my friend, my food for the journey, my journey's end. You are my breath, my hope, my companion, my craving, my abundant wealth. Without you, my life, my love, I would never have wandered across these endless countries. I look everywhere for your love. Then suddenly, I am filled with it.
Rabia's poetry has entered the hearts of so many and has inspired British Muslim musician Sami Yusuf to honour a woman whose piety was second to no man.
I only knew love when a new love of me. I sealed up my heart against thy enemy. I stood long in converse with thee who doth see my heart's inner secrets, but though I don't see, my love is twin loves, yet the twain are for thee. The first for thy love, and the others for thee. And as for the first, which is love of thy love, remembrance complete, not distracted from thee. Remembrance complete, not distracted from thee.
Rabia al-Adawiyya was not the only female scholar of Islam. Recently, a male Indian scholar, Sheikh Akram Nadvi, uncovered over 8,000 accounts of female scholars. Each of them nod in lament to a lost legacy of Islamic female scholarship, one that urgently needs to be reclaimed. The Quran states men and women are spiritual equals, and Prophet Muhammad said women are the twin halves of men. Removing women from scholarship leaves us with only half the story. Only together can both men and women bring balance, justice, and understanding of the divine, universal messages. Camille Helminski, in her book Women of Sufism, writes,
"Women and men need to stand together in the light. The masculine attributes of strength and determination also belong to women. The feminine attributes of receptivity and beauty also belong to men. As we look to see the divine in each other, encouraging each other to rise to the fullness of his or her own divine nature, we push against our own limitation until those limits dissolve and a gift unfolds."
Hey, oh, hey, hey, ha, hey, ay, oh, hi, ah.
The gift seeks us. A return to the sacred feminine essence can restore the balance, heal the wounds of misogyny, and reconnect us to our humanity. I am awed by the influence of female saints. I'm empowered by the spiritual activism of the suffragettes. And I value the versatility of the sacred feminine, from Avalon's priestesses to African deities. The divine feminine has many faces. The nurturing love of a tender mother, the power of a dynamic leader, the enlightened wisdom of a sage. Yet the mystery prevails. It forms an essential part of the ongoing search for meaning, origin, and return to the divine, all-encompassing essence.